go. Very excited to welcome everybody to the Eric Lang Show. Mostly our guest today, Mr. John O'Hurley. First, we'll describe the location. John, we're in the financial district of Manhattan.
The financial district, yes, I'll tell you. In the middle of construction, actually. Everywhere you look, yeah. You don't have to look too far, and you find nothing but cranes and high-rises being built, and it's pretty amazing down here, the way that the infrastructure is turning from kind of urban chic to residential.
Yeah, everything is growing.
People are moving down to the financial district to live, not just to work.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting how Manhattan, like, having lived here and coming back, whatever, every few months or every year or something, you sort of, like, every time it's very different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into, You've done so many things, right? You've got, you're doing a play. You're doing a Chicago play.
I'm on Broadway, with Chicago, which is the longest running American musical in Broadway history. It's been running now for 22 years. I've had it for 12 years, on and off, both on the road, and this is my fifth stint back on Broadway with it. I love it, and I've done over 2,000 performances of it. So,
I don't know if I've done anything 2,000 times, except hit a golf ball, maybe.
You know, yeah. The repetitions are everything, aren't they?
obviously a lot of people are going to recognize you, your voice probably, from your, you know, you have this. Do you get annoyed when people recognize you from the famous line, from the famous character you portrayed?
No, not at all. Oh, no. The fact that anybody gives a rat's ass about what I've done at any one point in my life is I look at it and go, thank you. I'm deeply flattered.
Right. So it's Mr. Peterman, Elaine's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I guess we can just touch on that briefly. I mean, you know, I was born in 81, so I grew up with that show as like a go-to for like a, and I've actually come to realize recently that comedy is quite therapeutic,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't really have that understanding until later in life. I mean, I'm not that old, but, and so what was it like for you? You started out, did you know what was going to happen? Where were you at in the process of the sort of cultural icon that is that show?
Well, it kind of caught me by surprise. I was actually I was busy killing another series at the time called A Whole New Ball Game, which was a very fun, one of the funniest shows I've ever done. It just couldn't find a home on ABC. And so we were canceled on a Thursday morning. They called and said, don't bother coming to work. They pulled the plug on the show, which is what any network does.
That's quite abrupt.
Yeah, I know. It's very abrupt. And so I went out to dinner with my manager that night, crying in my beer, trying to take the cancellation as personally as I possibly could. And lo and behold, Larry David's office called and said, we heard, you know, the cancellation, and there's this guest star that we're writing in this week, and we think John could kind of chew it up and have a lot of fun with it. And originally I said no. Because I said, I'm still looking at my wounds over the cancellation. And so I said to my manager, tell him thank you, but I don't want to go guest star on somebody else's series after I had my own series just canceled. So I said, all right. So he never called. The next morning he called me and said, just get up and go over there and have some fun. Blow it out of your system. And I said,
That's a good manager.
Well, yeah, I know. So I walked over, I went over to the two, and I had, they didn't even finish the script. They had the most disorganized show on television over at Seinfeld.
Really?
They had about half of the script done, and the Peterman character was so thinly written, they hadn't even fleshed the character out yet. They handed me the catalog and just said, "Read the catalog a little bit to get an idea. We just want him to sound the way the catalog is written." And of course, the catalog has these pastel drawings and this Hemingway-style adventure copy of, I was climbing K2 in my Oxford button-down, and it
laughing.
Was so I looked at it, and it kind of struck me as a bit of a 40s radio drama combined with a bit of a bad Charles Kuralt, so that really was the genesis, the origin of the character, and he just became during. And sure enough, by the end of the episode, she's working for me, and everybody looked at me, and they said, well, you've got a job. And I said, well, that's interesting. I said, as I say, I really backed into it. So, lo and behold, over the next 5 years, it became, or four seasons, I guess. He just became more and more of a raving lunatic, as kind of a corporate Mr. Magoo, if you will. the surreal Lou Grant, you know.
So you had a chance. You had a chance to really sink your teeth into it. It sounds like. I mean, especially.
Well, it was an absurdist show. I mean, that which was the beauty of Seinfeld was the fact that the writing could sustain these over-the-top characters, and he was as over-the-top as they ever got him. He was a raving lunatic, and I loved it because it gave me an opportunity to trust my comic imagination, that what I imagined had value, rather than looking at the standard comic script that you'd get in a sitcom. So I had to learn a whole new style of comedy in Seinfeld.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Was that because it was new for the generation?
Yes.
It was a new thing.
It wasn't another show. No, because the style of American sitcom is that you set the joke up and you deliver it. You set the joke up and you deliver it. There are no jokes in Seinfeld. If you read the script, it's not funny. The show is not funny. The scenes are funny. You play the scene honestly and it gets a laugh. But if there are no jokes in the show, there's no setup to the jokes. You have to go back and look at the way that, and it was nerve wracking for me because I said I'm trying to find the joke, and I just said and what I realized, if I just played the scene honestly, it was funny, and not relying upon the individual lines and trying to set yourself up and deliver a comic delivery, and so it's a new style of comedy for me.
I'm so excited to watch it again now because it's already something I love. I already look forward to it. Mm-hmm. Now, at what point do you, as because I know for myself, the projects that I've done, they're probably a little more personal than an actual actor, right? I go out and do this travel show where we play golf around the world, and I'm a host. Mm-hmm. But I identify myself with that deeply. Like I was thinking about how, I was looking at you and I was hearing you talk about Seinfeld, and I was thinking that on some level internally, do you identify with Mr. Peterman? Do you walk around?
Oh, absolutely. He really is. He's my alter ego. in many respects. He is. I like that. I like having that sense of absurdity. I am kind of that Irish poet on the cliff. I have that side to me, and. The only difference between me and Peterman is that Peterman would jump off the cliff. And that's the fun of it. I love the absurdity of that character. I get a kick out of him, and I like to play him. I keep him alive in advertising as well. He's an advertising hero now for many companies. So.
Is there any contractual complications there, or do you just sort of keep it loose?
No. The PS to the story on Seinfeld is that the year after Seinfeld ended, 1999, the real J. Peterman Company, there is a real catalog, John Peterman is the real J. Peterman, and he and I, over the run of the show, became very good friends. Only because, we were joined at the wrist and ankles. I had basically stolen his identity and had no plans to give it back. And sure enough, his company went through some financial difficulties about a year after Seinfeld ended. And I ended up buying the J. Peterman Company. And so he and I own it together as we speak. And... along with some other investors, and ever since then, I've been, I like the role so much, I bought the company.
You literally became.
I am the yes. As Marshall McLuhan once said, sooner or later, the message and the medium will become indistinguishable, and I'm the living example of that. I am. I like the role so much, I bought the company.
That's I do my research, but I love that I didn't know that.
Yes, it's a fun thing. Well, it's gotten quite a bit of traction in modern media. So it's been a lot of fun. I enjoyed the company. The J. Peterman Company is a phenomenal. I mean, they put a phenomenal product out. And if you go to jpeterman.com, to be shamelessly self-promoting, you'll enjoy what you see. It's a fascinating catalog.
Well, like you said, you backed into it. So it's
I did.
So I know you golf, and we'll get into that. But does Mr. Peterman golf?
Well, yes. There was the famous JFK golf club episode where I buy JFK's golf clubs from the actual auction. And they ended up to be, Kramer ended up to giving him the deep six out the back of a van full of returnable soda bottles. And they ended up all twisted. And of course, I think that that is because JFK had quite a temper. but yes, I would say Peterman did. He was a golfer. He was playing around with Ethel Kennedy. I think that's what he said. Yeah. He said, I'm playing around with Ethel Kennedy, a woman whose triumph in the face of tragedy is preceded only by her proclivity to procreate.
Women like that are great for planet Earth. So you grew up in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
You get into golf around 11. Is that right? Something like that?
I was playing all my life. I mean, going to the driving range with my dad was something we all did. But I never had formal lessons. We were lucky enough to belong to a country club in West Hartford, Connecticut, where I grew up most of my life. And took formal lessons over there. And golf became kind of my sport. I played on the golf team in high school, all through high school. We moved to Fort Lauderdale, where the golf got even more serious down there. You know, I mean,
In terms of competition for you?
In terms of just the level of playing. I mean, there were kids that were shooting in the 60s back then, you know. So, I had never seen that before, you know. If somebody shot in the 70s, that was, you know, I thought they walked on water. But when I got to see, some genuine golf or some genuine golf talent down in Fort Lauderdale, because, you know, the weather and the access to great courses and teaching down there was just so phenomenal that, the competition was much better.
So, a lot of people listening to this a lot of people listening to this are new to golf.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things people ask is like, what should I do? How can I, it sounds like you're a proponent of taking lessons. Can you talk about, I don't know how that's.
I absolutely do. I mean, anything in life worth doing is worth doing correctly. And there is, there are certain fundamentals that you have to learn in golf. I think people who just pick up the club and just start swinging it in a way, I think they're kind of I think they're headed down a path of frustration. And people, it just is. It's not a natural movement. It's a taught movement. So I think that, the first thing you do is go study the game and learn the game, learn the rules of the game, number one, and then study the fundamentals of the swing. I think you're really doomed to failure if you don't, and then you start to get into these habits that you have to unlearn, which I think was more golfers have, fundamental problems because they have never learned the fundamentals of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I notice for me in a swing lesson, it's the usual, the quotes that I give out are something like, that feels so weird. That feels so weird. Oh, wow, good shot. Wow, now it feels great. And it is interesting that it is so unnatural, and yet our favorite players make it look natural, You said that you're, a lot of people, I don't ever ask this question, dream foursome. I don't know why I don't ask it, but I noticed you answered it before, and you said that it was your family mainly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, yeah. The game, the game is part of the dynamic of the family. It's actually how I met my wife, how I got...
Whoa, whoa.
We were
really?
Engaged.
You met her on a golf course or something?
Well, she worked for the Golf Channel. Yeah, I'm married to a beautiful blonde scratch golfer. It's pretty tough, I tell you. That's I hate my life. You know, I hate my life. No, I'm very lucky to have to roll over every day and see a beautiful blonde scratch golfer there.
And you're both just watching golf and talking about the birdie yesterday.
She is, and we are, and the whole, and her whole family is in golf, as in mine as well. And she still is. She has her own golf line called Golfino, which is an
Italian. Wait, I love that brand.
Yes,
well, nice. I've bought stuff on that brand online, which is saying a lot because I don't really buy a lot of golf stuff.
That's right, but you're probably the right body type for it as well.
It's perfect. It's slim.
Yeah, it's very slimming stuff. Yeah, I wear it all the time. In fact, I'm surprised I'm not wearing it today.
It's not that. It's not. Is it? It's Italian.
It's actually German.
Oh.
It sounds Italian, but it is, it's the top, I would say the top brand in Europe, and she went over and made a presentation to them because it had never been in the United States before.
Yeah.
So she brought it over here, and she's now Golfino USA, and she has it in about 300 different clubs across the country.
So now someone's about to get fired on my end because I should fucking know this. Like, what the dude? This is so cool. Like, literally, I remember I bought the pants,
and
I bought the fabric's really nice. I bought the shirt that has the golf course image on it.
Oh, sure.
Remember that one?
Uh huh. Yeah.
It definitely gets a lot of it's a lot of attention, which is great. But that's so crazy. So wait, do you mind telling me the story of how you guys met? Because I love these
stories.
Sure.
Our first date was on the golf course, and I made sure that when I saw her hit the ball 250 yards down the middle of the fairway, and I looked at her and I go, this is a date, by the way. She has never missed the middle of the fairway ever since I've met her, I make a joke that I've never seen her in the woods before, but she takes the same golf ball that I bought her years ago and just puts it back in the sleeve, and she's never lost it, Yeah, she's that was our first date, and she worked for the Golf Channel at the time.
But how did you end up playing golf together?
I asked her out.
But how did you meet her before that?
Well, we had met actually at a golf tournament, the ESPYs, the ESPY Awards, had a golf tournament there in L.A., and so I was playing in that, and so was she. She was employee number 12 at the Golf Channel. Arnold Palmer hired her directly, and she was a brilliant student out of Baylor. She was, top of her class, I think, and a great golfer. She was on the golf team there at Baylor, and they, have won the NCAAs many times. She's that good. So we decided to meet and play golf, and we did, and I was absolutely enthralled by her. She was just absolutely so much fun, and we laughed, and we had a great time. So we actually got engaged on the seventh hole at Pebble Beach.
Yes.
The ring was in the hole. It was in a box in the hole, and I had hired a photographer to sit there in the gorse there to take pictures of the entire scene, and I had it set up so that we would go out there at 5:30 at night after the course was clear, and I arranged this with the pro there. So we drove out there, and of course it never occurred to her that you don't just get to go out and play the horse at 5:30 in the evening. And I said, bring a brand new $100 bill because we're going to have a skins game out on the seventh hole. And she said, great. So we packed up and went out there. And I had the whole thing arranged. And the box was already in the hole at the time with a 4-carat diamond ring.
Yes.
And I figured what I would do is take one extra club and I'd blow it into the back trap there on the famous par 3 there as the number 7, overlooking the ocean on maybe the most perfect day. Oddly enough, the wind was blowing out rather than in, and so in taking the extra club, I actually put it right next to the pin. And I went, oh no, this is not. And she hits it into the front trap. She hits it into the back trap, and I go, this is not going to go. This is not the scenario that I wrote.
You're going to be pulling the pin.
Then she blades the only downhill sand shot that she's ever hit into the front trap. She gets it about 15 feet from the pin, and as she's walking past me, at least I said to her, if I can get her to just pull the pin, she'll... I said, well, let me just pull the pin, and I'll put you out of your misery, which only made her madder.
Oh.
So she pulls the pin. She goes, I can't. There's a box in it. And I said, oh, really? And so she picks up the pin and the box, throws them both away over towards the side of the cliff by the crashing surf. And I went, and I went, oh my. And then she said, and then as she walks past me, she pushes me down and she says, oh, you, and I was just about to drop to my knee to do my proposal. And she pushes me over. She says, you won your $100. Just leave me alone. And now I'm lying on the ground, figuring this is not the way this is supposed to be going here. And as I'm lying on my back, looking straight up at the sky, I said, sweetie, the box was for you. And she broke out, burst into tears, because she knew exactly what it was instantly. What I hadn't figured was that she still had her golf glove on, so I couldn't put the ring on. But that's how we got engaged. And by the way, I won the $100, the most expensive $100 I've ever won. It just that was the gift that just kept on taking. So golf has been a big part of the dynamic of our life. In fact, if you go to Pebble Beach in the magazine that they have there, they still have that story about engaging there.
That is.
Yeah, it was a wonderful time. It's always been a wonderful moniker for us to have the. That seventh hole of Pebble Beach, a special place.
Right, right. The box is for you. Mm-hmm. When you said it, hit me when you said that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know where to go after that. That's fucking. That's the best story that's ever been told on this podcast. Where do we go from there? What I was going to say is, I've had some first dates on a golf course, kind of, and they're it's different. It's not terribly romantic.
No, it isn't. Is it?
You know, on some level, you're probably not playing on a team,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually, you're playing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first time you've ever done that?
No, I actually dated a golfer prior to that, and I liked it a lot. I liked the idea because it was you spend 4 hours together. It's wonderful. I loved it, and I liked playing with somebody very good. You know, I got a kick out of somebody being as good or better than me. I like that idea. It's fun. A lot of fun to be able to do it. And it's even more fun now when we play golf tournaments together. I'll bring my wife along. And, of course, you know, the guys will, it's like a scramble or a charity, you know, these typical celebrity charity scrambles that you play. And I'll bring, you know, my wife along and they'll kind of say, oh, sure, she can play, like that. And, on the first hole, she'll, you know, from the ladies' tee, she can usually drive the par four. So, you know, it's exactly right, yeah. So all of a sudden the eyes open up, you know, and it's like they realize they've got a ringer very quickly. So that's a lot of fun. And I never say much about it. I just kind of let the talent speak for itself.
How do you handle, I feel like I would like that as well. And it's never quite happened for me. Usually I met my course in LA, and usually I get a lot of jabs from the guys in the pro shop when I'm out there giving a lesson to some girl, and you know, it's always like they'll do a few lessons, they'll kind of get into it, but it's hard to get them to be it takes a long time, it's a long road. Mm-hmm. What I was going to ask was, what do you make of the whole joke? Does your wife play? I don't know. I never asked her. I don't understand. I mean, I guess I get it, but at the same time, I'm like, I love this game.
Yeah.
I fucking love this game, and I love her.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't we go to New Zealand and play golf every fucking day?
And that's exactly what we do. We went to New Zealand.
There you go.
You know, after her reward for carrying my son for nine plus months, was I took her down to New Zealand for 2 weeks, and we... went to Kauri Cliffs, we went to Cape Kidnappers, we went, did the whole experience. And I'm a fly fisherman, and she's also a decent fly fisherman. So I took her helicopter fishing for rainbows down there. So it was a phenomenal experience, and that was, yeah, sure. It's a wonderful way to wrap around. I mean, usually when we go somewhere, golf is involved. For many years, I was lucky enough to be invited to the Dunhill Cup, the links in October over there, and when they found out how good my wife was, they included her as an invitation, and she almost won it 1 year. And if you, you know, and there was...
Is that a standard pro-am?
Or, it's,
or it's just a celebrity tournament?
No, it's a pro-am.
So who is she playing with when she almost won?
Well, she's had several. Alejandro Canizares. Okay. She's had every year you get a new pro. Okay. And we've played it for about 7 years, so it's quite a... And you play Carnoustie, King's Barnes, and the old course at St. Andrews. So it's pretty spectacular. And that's where we met. That's where she was introduced to Golfino. Golfino has a store, an in-house store, right there at the Old Course Hotel. That's how we became the top purchasers of Golfino. And now we are Golfino. So it's a little bit like it's the Peterman story all over again in many respects.
I was just going to say that. No, so. Can I ask, this is on the fly, but I feel like this is going to be a gold here. Can Mr. Peterman spend as much time and describe St. Andrews as possible? I would love to hear that. You know what I mean? How does he see it? Like, sell it to me.
Yes, a rounded sailor. St. Andrews, St. Andrews, flat as a pancake. And it leaves one on one's knees. Because if double bogey were a fabric, I would be draped in it.
That's good.
Adidas golf shoes, y'all. My favorite pair, I'm going to go with Adipure. I like the Tour 360 knit. Yeah, the knit one. Check out what DJ's wearing and get into that, my guy. Nothing compares to a pair that I wear on the course every time I play. It's true, y'all. I don't miss not being able to wear any other golf shoe because contractually I can only wear Adidas at this point. But the truth is, I couldn't imagine a better situation. And you know what? A little behind the scenes, I went to Adidas and I was like, look, guys, let me not wear any other golf shoe ever. And they were like, yes, sir. And I was like, yes. And then my agent was like, this contract is signed. Anyway, now all I wear is Adidas and I couldn't be happier. Comfort and stability is hard to find in golf shoes, but Adidas delivers every time. Quite literally every goddamn time. I've had so many friends tell me how comfortable their golf shoes are, how uncomfortable their golf shoes are, and I always tell them, buy Adidas, Boost, and my guy. Get into the Boost, y'all. Literally. It's very easy for me to talk about them because I actually like them. You can't beat Boosts. It's so comfortable. So basically, Adidas golf shoes, and then they're what? There's basically Adidas golf shoes, and then there's every other brand. True facts. No comparison. Adidas golf shoes every time, my guy. You can buy a pair at your local retailer or visit adidas.com and go to the golf section. Because where else do you want to go on adidas.com? You only want to go to the golf section to buy golf shoes. Also, follow adidas.com. I'm sorry. Follow Adidas Golf on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook for all the latest news and releases. Oh, big update. All right. Thanks, y'all. Yeah, all right, everybody. Want to lose 21 pounds? A set of clubs and a bag can weigh 21 pounds, so leave your sticks at home the next time you travel. I didn't realize it was 21 pounds. Jeez. Visit clublender.com and select the clubs you want from among Callaway, TaylorMade, Titleist, and PXG. And select your dates. Not just Majul dates, folks. We're talking dates on a calendar. Clublender will deliver the clubs in a premium vessel bag. Yes, vessel. That's cool. The day before your round to any hotel, course, home, or office in California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona. California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona. If you want to rent anywhere else in the good old United States of America, give them a call and chat with them online, and they'll try to set you up with clubs. They have lefty and righty, stiff and regular, men's and women's. Better yet, the clubs come with tees, a divot repair tool, and a ball marker, and a wet almond-scented towel. I'm just kidding. It's a regular, dry, unscented towel. If you need a range finder, a glove, or balls, they can send them along too. Going to Vegas, San Diego, Scottsdale, Frisco. I don't know. Who's going to Frisco, guys? If you're going to Frisco, I don't know. You might just want to switch that decision up. Just playing 1 or 2 days and don't want to lug your clubs the entire trip? That's me, y'all. Raise your hand. Clublender's got you covered. Use the code Eric Lang as a coupon code at clublender.com and get 10% off your first order. That's the code Eric Lang, E-R-I-K-L-A-N-G. That'll get you 10% off your first order. Own the experience, not the hassle. Because who likes hassles? I do not. Who likes experiences? I do. Clublender.com. Coupon code Eric Lang, E-R-I-K-L-A-N-G. That'll get you 10% off your first order.
I can't, I have a hard time identifying with someone who can walk up 18 without getting tremendously emotional.
It is, it's pretty, well, you know what's even more fun is having my wife over there, because, first of all, women don't look like her on a golf course. I mean, she is one of the prettiest women I've ever seen in my life, and an absolutely exquisite body. And onwards of about the 14th hole at St. Andrews, you get this long kind of side path that goes along the side of the golf course. And the townspeople gather at the foursomes, and then they follow it. It can follow the foursomes as they go into town and not have to pay the price or, you know, there's no entry fee that way. Well, when she hits the 14th hole, all of a sudden this group of 18-year-old boys gather. And she has her own cheering section of 18-year-olds that see this beautifully outfitted woman hitting the ball straight down the middle, you know. And so by the time she gets to 18, that walk up 18, she's got, you know, it's like it might as well be Christie Brinkley. So it's that's a lot of fun to watch that. She has her own fan base over there.
Right.
That's great.
That's wonderful. Yeah. But talk a little bit about, we talked a little bit about your dream foursome, the idea of playing with your family. I learn about golf every day, right? My life is golf. Everything I do is golf. I continue learning. The dream foursome question, I feel like, is a bit of a mistake, right? Because everyone thinks Gandhi, The Rock, whatever. And I, those are my answers sometimes. But, well, I mean, why do we play golf?
Mm-hmm.
And why do you play? I mean, if that's your dream foursome, I feel like you have an answer that's in line with probably a lot of how I feel about golf. One of my favorite rounds in my life was at a not terribly significant golf course with my mother, my father, and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just a moment where I realized this is my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it thanks to the caddy who said, "You don't realize it yet, but you'll remember this round in 20 years."
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so is there a connection there for you to those things and why you play golf?
Sure. I started the game as a way to spend 4 hours with my father. And my father plays today at the age of 90 so that he can spend 4 hours with me. So it's a passing of the baton at some point in your life. And I would say the saddest day of my life was the day I first beat my father.
Really?
Yes. Because that is, you realize, I remember the first time I beat him playing chess. I was about 14 years old, and I went, oh, no. I hated it, because you always want to believe that your father is the best, you know what I mean? So it's the passing of the baton, and I was deeply saddened by it. Isn't that interesting? You try your hardest to be competitive, and then, you know, it's like what happens when the dog finally catches the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus, man, you hit me with two fucking serious bangers there with the... The father statement,
mm-hmm.
I can't even remember what you just said. You said, now he spends 4 hours to play with me. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's Cats in the Cradle right there.
Mm-hmm.
Cats, that's the Cats in the Cradle.
That's exactly right, yeah.
okay, fine. Next. I feel like you probably have an answer to this beyond something like patience. What has golf taught you? Yeah, something really deep, right? Yeah.
You know, it isn't. It's very simple. I'm a great believer in individual responsibility, that I control my destiny. I believe that in every aspect of my life, no one is responsible for me except me, and I am not my circumstances. So the combination of the two is of accepting the personal responsibility and realizing that you are not your circumstances gives you the perfect playing temperament for the game of golf, I think. That no matter how bad your situation is, there's always a way out of it. And the fact that you were the person who put yourself into that situation.
Right.
It was nobody else. So I like that. I like that, that golf is constantly teaching me about that. I am also blessed with no long-term memory. You know for a fact, and you've met, I know people like Jimmy Woods, James Woods, actor. If you play golf with Jimmy Woods, he remembers every single hole, every stroke. I mean, that's the kind of mind he has upstairs. So you will have to endure not only playing the round with him, but the retelling of the round, hole by hole by hole. I have no memory of that. When I leave a golf course, I have no idea what I just shot or how I scored. I have it doesn't matter to me. While I'm playing it, I'm deeply involved in it, deeply frustrated by it. And I wear my emotions on my sleeve. And but when somehow when the game is over, it's gone. I have no memory of it. I've been released from it. So it's so for me, I guess, you know, golf is as I say, a wonderful chance to recognize individual responsibility and that everything is redeemable.
What you said earlier when you were describing, you know, what you touched on, sort of almost manifestation, and then you kind of touched on, I don't know, something else, but whatever it was, it pleasantly sounded and smelled a bit like it's a spiritual game for you.
Oh, it is very much a game. Yeah, I think there is an absolute spirituality to the game of golf. I believe in it tremendously.
Is there a spiritual aspect to your life outside of golf that would help clue me into how you see golf? Like, I mean, it sounded like you're like Buddhist and you're going on meditation.
Well,
retreats.
No, I mean, I do a lot of motivational speaking to corporations around the country. So I kind of walk my talk, I do believe very much in the essential notion of the present moment, of living in the present moment, that nothing else matters other than the present moment. That if man has one great problem in life, it is the burden of time. It's the fact that we are always thinking about what we have to do or what we have done. It is the expectation of the future and the shame of the past. And nobody lives in the present moment. Golf is all about living in the present moment. It is what it is, right there. So if you can free yourself of what you just happened on the previous hole or your expectations of the next shot and just live in the moment, then you have the perfect temperament to play the game of golf.
For those of you listening, you can't see the eye contact that John just made with me, and it was intense. Like, I can feel that you're able to sit in that moment. Like, a lot of people, you can tell aren't listening or knowing what they're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. When you look into somebody's eyes for 10 seconds, you realize how often you never do.
You know, you reminded me of a quote that I read yesterday, which is, I can't remember who attributed it. I can't attribute it to who the author was, but it was, death ultimately destroys a man, but the idea of it saves him. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're into that.
Very much so.
I had something else. I can't remember.
But let me just embellish on that just a little bit. Please. I would say of all of the golfers that I know, all the pros, I would say are quiet people inside. I think that is the one common denominator among all successful golfers, is that there's a stillness in them. And I look at people like Brad Faxon. You can look into Brad's eyes and just see that that is the quietest man. And when he holds on to a putter, you can see there's a gentleness to the way that he manipulates that iron. And you can see why he's such a good putter, because he's still. And you can see it's the spirit inside of him. And I find that to be, you look at a good pro, the way that they stand over the ball when they putt it, and you'll just see it, the stillness of the spirit, and as opposed to me, who I mean I grip it like I'm trying to milk a bull moose, you know. you put a putter in my hands and I bring the bunkers back into play.
Yeah, that's a fun experience, degreening a ball. What's your have you ever milked a bull moose?
an expression I used on camera once, and I think they had to cut it out of the show.
It was a bit before its time.
Apparently so, yeah.
moose are apparently very aggressive creatures. Mm-hmm. I was just, as a fly fisherman, you've probably been to Jackson, mm-hmm. Wyoming.
Sure, sure.
Some great golf there.
Yeah,
have you played there?
I have not.
Dude, no. You got it.
Yeah.
So there, the elevation is quite a factor, and I mean, I can hit a ball 290, 300, mm-hmm. you know, around there, if I really hit a good one. Mm-hmm. I can also hit it 260, and I can hit it longer. Average drive up there was like 340. And on some, it got 380. Mm. I mean, the fairways were a bit hard, but it's all the elevation.
We play up in every year, the last 26 years now. I've been playing in the NBC Tahoe tournament there, NBC Celebrity Championships. And I find a way to screw my way to the middle somehow up there. But we're up there about 6,500 feet, so we get that
same thing.
that kind of extra roll that you get. Now, my wife, circling back to my wife, this year called me one day, and we have a little bounty that she and I have for a hole in one. It's a $100 bounty, so you can see that the $100 figure comes back into my life quite a bit. She called me and she goes, "You owe me $100." I said, "What happened?" She goes, "Well, I got an ace." I said, "You're kidding." She says, "Yeah, it just happened." And she said, "I think it's going to have to be a little more than $100. I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "It was on a par 4.
No.
285 yards uphill, par 4.
What?
And she aced it. And she was with borrowed clubs. She was playing with the pro. She was showing him her golf line, and then they went out and played. And not only that, it was with a borrowed golf ball. So she had everything about it was borrowed.
Wow.
285 yards, Eagle Springs, or up in Vail.
Okay.
She uphill 285. And the pro said it's never been.
No.
I asked Annika Sorensen when we were out with them in at Tahoe this year. I said, "Have you ever heard of anything like?" She goes, "I've never heard of anybody acing a 285-yard par 4. I only gave her $100. I'm saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's the limit of my patience.
There was no fine print. Yeah.
And that's her. That's her third hole in one.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That probably counts as two.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I wonder the numbers, right? Because a lot of people have hole-in-ones. You have one, at least, I know.
I have one. I had one at the BMW, the web.com tournament.
And they famously didn't give you a BMW?
No. Isn't that funny? You don't know. Yeah. What I got was a one-year membership to a health maintenance organization in Columbia, South Carolina. So translated, it means anytime I had post-nasal drip, I had to hop on a plane and go down to South Carolina. And that didn't end. I was so mad that I didn't get the BMW because I said, and now everybody gets the BMW, but not posthumously.
You got to go retroactive.
That was a lot of fun though. But actually, and my wife got to see it because she was in the foursome in front of me. See,
aww.
Again, the dynamic of par three and something in the hole.
I'm willing to, what is your favorite? I mean, you've been interviewed a lot, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite question that people ask you? I mean, you know, because there must be questions where you're like, I can sink my teeth into that one. Is there something that you really like? Not that I'm going to ask it to you, but I'm just...
No. We touched upon it earlier. I like to talk about meaningful things. You know, I like to discuss ideas, and those are the things that I enjoy. If I sit down with somebody over a glass of wine or something, I'd much rather sit back and talk about, you know, concepts. I'm much happier in that. Because I always feel then it's time well spent.
Yeah.
I hate discussing politics. I hate talking about people. I hate, you know, it's just, I don't feel like I'm spending my time at my best.
I don't like discussing politics either. In fact, I can't even follow it for obvious reasons. But I guess I'm curious to know why you don't like discussing politics.
Well, because I have found, and especially over the last decade or so, there is such an emotional and visceral reaction to politics that we have become less tolerant of people thinking differently than we do, that we don't allow the freedom, that people have a different perspective. And that's really what politics are, is that I have a certain view of the world, and you will probably have a different view of the world, but it doesn't make either one of our views any less valid. What you imagine has value. That's my premise in life. And if you don't believe that, then you have denied another person their right to think differently. And I think that's one of the things that makes this country great, is that everybody has the opportunity to think differently. And what we are trying to do lately with this political divisiveness that we have is we are denying each other the opportunity to think differently. And that's what I object to. I don't care what you think of. I absolutely defend your right to think that way. And I want the same freedom for myself. And unfortunately, we don't allow that anymore. You have to think the way that, you know, for every us, there has to be a them. I don't agree with that.
So it sounds like you're the kind of guy who walks up to anybody and tries to find something in common to be able to connect. Is that true?
I would say so. I try to imagine the four-year-old child in every other human being.
Whoa.
I do. It's part of what I speak about when I speak to corporations. I said it becomes the whole nature. I speak in terms of three elements in life, and it's called the Peterman Guide to the Extraordinary Life. And there are three elements of it. One is imagination. One is contemplation. We've talked about those. The idea of what you imagine has value, and that it is only in the present moment that you realize the wonder of the world, and not in the living in the future or the shame of the past. In the peace, to be stunned by the present moment and the things that are going on. And then finally, the third element is appreciation. And appreciation is recognizing the inherent value and the inherent vulnerability in every human being. And I identify that through the first day I took my son to kindergarten. And I realized these little kids, and they were scared to death of being in that line. They didn't know anybody, and all the kids were older and bigger than them, and they all just kind of stood around. And I said, that, I understand what appreciation is now, and it's recognizing the value which you see in the child, but also the inherent vulnerability that everybody is broken. Everybody is broken in some fashion. And that's what, if you can recognize that, then everybody has value. Everybody has value. And then, so you try to find that value. And you try to see that in every child, I mean, there's, and I say 4 years old because that four-year-old is still in me. It never changed. I still see the world as I did when I was four, and I remember the way that I saw the world. It hasn't changed. So that four-year-old still lives in me. So I try to use that really as a frame of reference for what I believe is the nature of pure appreciation.
That's wonderful. I want to now. You were talking, and then I had a moment where I thought of two things. One, well, you is that why we love golf in some ways? Because it creates, for me, one of the reasons why I love golf is because it's one of the things that it's almost like a magnifying glass on my emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, like I almost go to it so that I can get frustrated. Mm-hmm. And so that I can feel like that experience of overcoming difficulty. Mm-hmm. And because it's not as acute, it's not as simple out there in the world, right? In golf, it's very much like the ball should go where I want it to go, and it should bounce the way I think it should bounce, and it's just black or white, really, mm-hmm. as far as the action that affects the feeling that I'm about to have around the result. Is that something for you?
Absolutely, and I think it's a way to come in contact with the infinite possibility. Golf is the act of the infinite possibility. Anything can happen at that moment. But it's all under your control. And that's what I like about it. That is a complete human experience to me. And that's what golf is. That's what golf is. I'm not reacting to anything. You know, baseball is a reactive sport. Tennis is a reactive sport. Yeah. Golf is a proactive. Everything is in your hands and your responsibility. You know, that's why I love it. That's why I love it.
So you sort of slid in there a few minutes ago, your life's premise. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, as I said, I believe in imagination, I believe in contemplation, and I believe in appreciation. And those three elements, I think, lead to what I refer to as the extraordinary life. I met a man back in 1991 as we were cruising through the Arctic Circle on the longest. Of course we are. I'm Jay Peterman.
Yeah, I was like, okay, and, Mr. Peterman.
And I met this man. It was an elderly gentleman named Barry. And I was instantly just attracted to the size of his spirit. He was just such an interesting, interesting person. And sitting on the poop deck there at midnight, and it was still looking about 4 in the afternoon as we were passing through the Arctic Circle, longest day of the year, 24-hour sun. I'm sitting there with a glass of wine talking to him, and I asked him to what he attributed his success. And he was a multimillionaire. I'm probably cheating him by a few decimal points in saying that. But he was a very well-off man. And I said to what he owed, I asked him to what he owed his success. And he lit with a little twinkle in his eye. He grabbed my arm and he says, John, I'll tell you got two choices in life. You can have an ordinary life, or you can have an extraordinary life. And that's it. That's the choice you make. And I said, okay, I get it. And I always remember that. And I thought about it, and I've written about it, and I've written 3 books. But they all go back to the notion of living the extraordinary life. And that is kind of the premise of my life, is to live life extraordinarily. And it has nothing to do with money or power, but has everything to do with the richness and the power of the choices that you make.
I hate to bring it back into a less wonderfully conceptual
But you have to cut away for
place.
A commercial? Is that what you're saying?
But here's a word from our sponsor. No, how do you live an extraordinary life? People are going to want to fucking know. They're driving around. They're doing their thing, and they're like,
go back again.
I'm in traffic.
Say, if you live by your imagination, not by your rational mind, you live by your imagination. Your imagination are the pictures in your mind. It's a 24-hour assessment of who you are, what you are, and your imagination cannot lie to you. It's the only thing that's honest inside of you. Your rational mind will lie to you because it has a fight or a flight syndrome. It has a natural protection. It is afraid of the undertow. It has its own agenda. Your imagination does not. If you live by what you imagine, all the things that I have done, you say I have an eclectic career. Well, I'll answer that by saying I have an eclectic career because I've always listened to my imagination. And if my imagination tells me I should go write a book, I write a book. If it tells me I should go compose an album, I go compose an album. If it tells me I should do this, you know, I should go write a one-man show, I write a one-man show. I never question my imagination. I always follow it, and it's provided me the richness of my life so far. The second aspect of the extraordinary life is living life contemplatively, living in the present moment, to be as close as you can to just living in that moment, so that you can experience the wonder that's going on in every second of your life. But if I'm constantly worried about what's going to happen or what hasn't happened or what did happen, then I'm missing I'm not clued into what's going on. And I've had the experience, but I've missed the meaning. The final thing is by living by appreciation. And as I say, that's recognizing the value and the vulnerability in every human being. And from that, the motivation to be generous will come. But that's the fundamental nature of what appreciation is all about. So those are the 3 elements of living extraordinarily: imagination, contemplation, and appreciation. And if you live that, you will live extraordinarily. And here's the trick: you got to have all 3, not 2, not 1 of 3, but all 3.
I agree, obviously. I think one of the things that I struggle with personally is the imagination I got. I sometimes struggle with I guess I have the imagination and I jump back into rational. And then
everybody does.
And I screw my idea over and I talk myself out of doing the work.
The world is littered with ideas that were dropped at the 5-yard line.
Whoa.
It's littered.
With 95 yards to go?
Uh-huh.
Jeez. Yeah. How do you not do that? How do you work?
Well, I formed a habit of doing it, so it's easier for me to do it, because I know I'm never wrong. if I follow my imagination. I know that if I follow my rational mind, it will be afraid. That my rational mind knows fear. My imagination doesn't. It can't lie to me. It's a 24/7 assessment of who I am and where I should be going. I have never once imagined that I should be playing in the NBA.
Really?
No. My imagination won't take me there. My imagination will take me to what I should be doing within the scope of my life. And it's never led me wrong.
So you don't... Sorry. Just moving the camera. That might be an interesting shot. You don't...
It's
so,
the nostril shot. It's a good thing I'm not wearing a dress.
No, we'll see. Yeah, maybe move it over here. At what point do you... there you go. Really high... Actually, John, I think you'll be pretty... This actually looks really good, this kind of stuff. Sorry, everybody. So, I'm trying to think of an example from my own life. I don't think I have one. What I was going to ask you, what advice would you give to young creatives, but I feel like you already did.
Mm-hmm. Trust your imagination.
Yeah.
And the interrelation between the two, because... It's through stillness that you open your imagination. So there's an interrelation between all three elements of what I consider the extraordinary life. They depend upon one another.
Man, I mean, I don't know. This has been way more intense than I was expecting.
I know.
Was it for you too? What were you expecting?
No, it's just the stuff that I enjoy talking about. It to me, it's all there is, really. You know.
Yeah.
You know, the rest is just wrapping paper.
I am kind of curious to know what a normal day for you is.
Well, a normal day for me, and again, I'm on Broadway right now, so my day is really, you know, my free time. I usually get up and do my crossword puzzles. Or my Sudoku or something like that over coffee in the morning, something to trigger my mind.
What time do you usually get up?
It depends on how late the show was or whether I went out afterwards. And so I'm 7:30 probably.
Do you have like a mandatory sleep amount that you look for?
No, I'm a restless sleeper. I sleep until about 4 in the morning, then I get up for an hour and then go back to sleep again too. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just... my nature.
You've got things to do.
Yeah, it's just my mind is always running and racing around. But I have a lot of other things outside of entertainment that I do. I have an energy company that I'm running, a waste-to-energy company that's moving up the echelon quite quickly now. It's a proprietary technology that doesn't exist anywhere in the world.
It sounds like Back to the Future.
It does. It's exactly what it is. It is the flux capacitor. I have the... Seriously.
Are you kidding?
No, seriously.
This is my favorite movie on Earth.
Uh-huh. Well, it is the flux capacitor, but it's on a large scale. So we take any form of waste and turn it into large amounts of energy, but we do it with zero emissions. So what it means is I can do coal without any emissions, which has never been done before. I can take all forms of municipal solid waste, your garbage, and... You don't have to put, you'll zero out any landfill on it. You don't need landfills anymore. This takes all of it and turns it into large amounts of usable energy, either liquid or liquid fuel or electricity, anything you need, it'll do it. And it does it with absolute zero emissions. So it's ramping up right now. We're producing these units all around the world, and it's going to be.
What's the company called?
Well, it's called Gold Seal, but if you go to energy-inc.com, you'll see the technology of what we have. But it's pretty interesting.
I'm sure some people will be interested.
Yeah.
And then what is the Broadway situation like? I mean, how does it even manifest itself in your life? I mean, you just get into a cab and
I show up to the theater about an hour before the show and kind of have my relaxing time up there. As I've said, I've done the show I've done the show 2,000 times, and before I walk on stage every night, just before I walk on stage, and I have the greatest entrance in Broadway history on the...
I haven't seen it. I need to see it.
Chicago is one of the great musicals ever performed on Broadway. It is just an absolutely timeless show. And it has, you know, Billy Flynn, the character I play, he's the shrewd... silver-tongued lawyer, And I have the best entrance any man has ever made. I have a dozen women in lingerie screaming, "We want Billy," seductively gyrating in front of me, and I make an entrance. But before I make that entrance every single night, I bow my head and I say one quick prayer, and that is this: God, let me be surprised. That's all I say. And it calms me down, gets me back into the present moment, and I know that somewhere during the next 2.5 hours, I'm going to find a surprise. So to say that the role is 2,000 times richer than when I started it 12 years ago is an accurate statement.
So I think you already answered my next question, which is, do you have any off nights? And I feel like the answer is no.
Never.
Never.
Never have an off night.
Never.
Never. I always... In fact, because the show just gets richer and richer and richher for me. I don't know how to phone it in, because I'm there. I'm in the electricity of the moment every single night. And that's how the show becomes rewarding to me. It's fun to go out there and just play. I'm still doing a play in the basement for my parents every night, you know.
Do you get nervous then? No. Have you ever?
Yes.
You must have had to work through it at some point.
No one had a deeper problem with stage fright than I did.
Really?
And this was in my early years on Broadway. But I talked myself out of it one night, and I said, this is ridiculous that you're getting this level of anxiety over something you've chosen to do for the rest of your life. I said, you can't survive this way. You'll kill yourself. And so I decided that night that I was going to throw the performance away and just go out and have fun on stage. That was my one objective. And I said, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to have fun. And sure enough, it was maybe one of the best performances I've ever given of that particular show that I was doing. And it opened up something inside of me. And I realized something, that the fear that I was holding was actually inhibiting me as an artist. And once I realized that I had no reason to be fearful, it released me from that and gave me a sense of just quiet. And something was so something could genuinely affect me on stage now, because I'm absorbing it rather than having a preformed impression of what I should be doing, and it was all locked up in here. You know, and it wasn't that I wasn't a decent actor. I was a decent actor, but I still had a stick up my ass. And once I relaxed, the stick fell out. And I started enjoying myself. And all of a sudden, it was the art of the infinite, again, the art of the infinite possibility out there on stage. So for me, everything was accessible.
Did that idea that one night sort of your... struggling, whatever. I don't know how long you'd been doing it, but the stage fright gets to a point where you finally break and try to do it differently. Did that idea of going out there and playing, did that have an origin? Did that come from somewhere?
Me?
Just you.
I just said I can't do it. Well, I've got to think. Well, I mean, I'm always a great believer of, you know, if you want to change your, you know, you want to change your feelings, change your thoughts.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, the feelings follow the thoughts. So change your thoughts and you change your feelings. And I was feeling tense, so I had to develop a different mechanism to work. And then that was the only thing that worked for me, was to just stop thinking that way and start trying another approach. And going out and having fun was my other approach. So, and it's given me a sense of trust too. And as I say that prayer that I say, God, let me be surprised. I say that before I go out to do Family Feud. Before I, you know, when any time I walk on stage, before I did Dancing with the Stars, I just say, God, let me be surprised.
What is behind that, let me be surprised? Because when I look at the thing, one of the things that scares me the most, ironically, I travel a lot, is flying. And I've gotten better with it. One of the things that helped me the most was I had a meditation teacher who I flew with once, and it was turbulent. And I said, dude, my fucking palms are sweating, and I'm terrified. Mm-hmm. I just keep seeing this plane going down. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, do you want to know what'll help? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, it's going to be weird. And I was like, yeah, just tell me, you know? And he's like, you're already dead. And as soon as he said it, I was like, oh man, my like chest opened up and I was fine with it. Like I was like, yeah, I'm already dead. Like I'm gonna die. I might as well live like I'm gonna die. Mm-hmm. Is there any of that in there? Mm-hmm. The idea of I guess it was like a giving up thing. I don't and it comes to golf too. I mean, why are Sunday scoring averages higher than Thursday? Because mm-hmm. people don't want to die.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you're trying to control. You're trying to grasp it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like let go and you're freer. Yeah, I mean, I've learned it. You know, the singing voice is a great example of that. The more you grip, the less you'll sing. You have, you know, by just letting the voice come out freely and learning how to support the mechanism and thinking of it as a kind of an expanding rubber band, you sing much better and much more freely. So.
I love the human voice and singing. Mm. Are you comfortable singing something from Chicago right now?
Not this morning, no.
How many nights a week do you do the show?
Eight shows a week.
Two on Friday, two on Saturday.
We do matinees and evenings on weekends.
Right.
So, Friday is tonight's Friday. So I'll have a 5-show weekend.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a grind, and I also drive my voice. I mean, I drive the show heavily on my voice. So the Sunday night, it's tired.
I can't wait to see it.
It's tired. But
do you have any questions for me? Usually, it's a no.
No.
Thank you so much for your time. I'm really.
Okay.
Just so pleased that everyone had a chance to listen to you talk about some things that obviously you think are important, but I think they will too. And I think ultimately, hopefully help whatever we're going through when we listen to this. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Have a good day, everybody.